Hello everyone and welcome to Celebrating Cinema. If you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe, leave us a review and share with friends. Following the world premiere of her debut feature at the opening of Netherlands Film Festival, I sat down with Dutch director Laura Hermanides to discuss her hyper-personal and intimate film Witte Flits, or White Flesh, which is now released in Dutch cinemas, including Lab 111. I would say let's dive into the frank and personal chat, which helped me a lot to enjoy this special film even more. Laura, welcome to Celebrating Cinema. So happy that you're here.
Very happy to be here.
Yes, well, with our podcast interviews, we always ask somewhat the same question to all of our guests, which is essentially a bit of your childhood film-going memories. Is there a particular memory or experience of watching a film or engaging with a film or going to a cinema from your youth that comes up when you think about this, a thing that left like an indelible mark to you?
Well, there's plenty straight on, but I think one that it really, lights up in my memory is a really an experimental art film, Die Lauf der Dingen, if my German is correct, but it starts with a wheel that's being released and it rolls down and it bumps into something, a garbage bag that starts spinning, and then that starts spinning wider and wider, and then it lights up something like a fire, and then it's like happenings and consequences all the time. And I was completely mesmerized by it. But I was so young that I was still having naps in the afternoon.
Can you describe like how old you were and in which context you saw it? How did this film came to you, basically?
I think I was about, must have been like 3 or something, because I still took naps. So it was at home, it was on television, and my mother insisted that I had to stop watching it to go have my nap. And then after my nap, we talked about it, that I was so amazed by it, and she actually regretted a little bit that she didn't let me finish watching the film, because she saw like a spark somehow. I was so into it. She said, actually, I should have let you watch it. Later on, at I think Film Academy, I looked for it.
Did you find it?
Yes.
And how was the experience of revisiting it?
Well, it's still interesting, but I guess there's this feeling of, I think, the two-dimensional screen with sound that makes it three-dimensional. It really made a huge impression on me, and I just love feeling that feeling of wanting to, like, please, 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 let me just sit here in front of this box a little bit longer, because I just want to know what's going to happen. Even though it's like it's an experimental film, but it's about that. It's like, I want to know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's still the power of stories.
Well, I'm amazed by two things here. First of all, that you have memories from when you were 3 years old, which is, do you retain a lot of childhood memories, or is that just a coincidence that it overlaps with a film memory as well?
Well, I do have a few. But for example, one is that I almost drowned in the sea in Portugal. That makes a big impression, of course.
Yes, that sounds pretty traumatic.
Well, it's actually, they say also, it's one of the best ways to die. I remember just being, looking up and seeing the water pass and the light in the background. And I remember the feeling of it being calm in a way.
That's oddly beautiful and very topical for the film that we'll get to very shortly. But I'm amazed by one other thing, is that apparently from a very young age onwards, you were very captivated apparently by the screen and the things that were happening on it. Did you maintain, let's say, a very healthy or strong or curious relationship with film and moving images and television and other things?
I was definitely into a lot of Disney films, and especially Fantasia was my...
Oh, amazing. That was one of my childhood favorites as well.
Yeah, it was really... We also used to go to the cinema. I remember going to Criterion once with a friend and his father. Cinema was completely empty, and we took the moment that we just would lie on the floor in front of the chairs looking at the screen, and it was like this feeling of the cinema all for you. This is like the most amazing thing. I do remember when you had to break the blue screen with the stars.
Oh, yes.
Like it's a break and you can go get a drink now. I guess thinking about it as something I would move into myself is, I even I guess when I was at the Film Academy, I didn't even realize that much that I was in the business, kind of.
Can you put some more words to that? Because it's very interesting. You know, we're talking right now because your first feature fiction film is being released. As of the moment of recording next week, it will have its premiere at the Netherlands Film Festival, where it's the opening film of the festival. This is obviously a moment where you have, let's say, a big break in the industry, and it's definitely very much establishing you somewhat. So from this perspective, can you maybe reflect a little bit on these first forays into filmmaking, maybe why you went to Film Academy, or was that a happy accident, or how would you describe the mindset that you had when you tried to get into filmmaking?
During high school, I got interested in organizing debates and stuff, and going out and meeting people and talking and thinking and film, because I ended up at the open day of the Film Academy, and I was really like, wow, this is so cool. Like, I left my number to help out as a production assistant, and I did extras, how do you say, guiding extras and
coordinating
stuff.
Or something.
Yeah, and then I skipped school in order to be able to work on Film Academy productions. Mm. I loved it. It was really, I really felt like, I think it was also an escape from this world that felt very tiny to me. Like, in high school, and everybody's kind of judging each other, and nobody feels comfortable, and it was really, yeah, it really felt like there's a door to another world, also with organizing debates. That's actually a nice way, how do you say, sexy, seductive way or something, to think about things. Mm-hmm. And that it's actually cool to, because I wanted to think about things. It's just in high school, that's not cool. In film school, that's cool. In organizing debates, that's cool.
I feel very seen, because I was also in a debate club in high school. Yeah, I loved it a lot. It was very nice. But it's also very funny that you say that, and it totally makes sense if I can use it as a bridge to extend to Witte de Flits, the film that we're talking about today, I think, mostly. Because this is a film that's obviously highly topical. It's the subject matter of a person that wants to have an assisted suicide, if I'm not mistaken, would be the best way to describe it in English. Euthanasie would be the best way to say it in Dutch. It's a highly sensitive subject matter, one that is often also in the news, often also a way that the world is looking into the way that we do things in the Netherlands. It's a subject matter that, for instance, I know in the States is a hot topic, and yet it happens here, but it happens under very specific conditions, and you explore them very consciously and very carefully and with a lot of attention in a way that I find very touching and beautiful, first of all. So a big compliment. Can you talk a little bit about the story, which is so topical, which has a lot of thorny, let's say, philosophical aspects to it that a lot of people debate over? So it is a film that people could debate over as well. That's why I was making the connection. What attracted you maybe to it? But also, do you see maybe a relationship between this history that you had of wanting to start discussions, to start debates, and then now using a film like this to create this discursive space, actually, to do that with?
Yeah, no, definitely. I guess life gets better when you get older. And there was the first point that I really felt I could breathe a little bit. I think in organizing the debates, I did miss something that I also would describe about Witte de Flits, White Flash, as a, that also, and maybe especially theoretical debates and questions we have and things we organize, I think we should also think about them from our gut and from our heart and from our souls, and not only from our minds. I think there's a, in something that's so existential as this, it's a danger when we only talk about it in theories. And that's also why I wanted to make the film, to see, like, I support the theory, but does it survive the practice of it, the reality? What does it look like?
And but then we're still in a very, let's say, theoretical space. How did the actual story manifest to you? Or how did you get so interested maybe in the story, or felt so captured by it? Did you also make, I would say, a pretty grave decision, which is, this is going to be my first feature film?
Well, my background is in documentary, and it's interesting to go back one moment to that moment that I applied for Film Academy, because first I was, after high school, I lived in Brazil for a bit and I worked in a, an orphanage, which I where I realized, like, okay, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And then I came back to study.
Beautiful phrasing, by the way. I love it.
Yeah, it's really what I learned there. And like the good Western intentions are really repeating the trauma of the kids by coming and disappearing again. But and then I came back and I wanted to study film, but I just thought first I need to study content, kind of like I need to. And also at the Film Academy at the time, they said you first have to have some like life experience. And at that time, you could still do two studies. Afterwards, they came with the Langstudeerboete, which I think is the most crazy.
Also highly topical, very much in the news again.
Yeah, very strange that you find people for studying. But okay, I went to study. I subscribed for philosophy. And then 3 days before it started, I was like, oh no, but I'm already so dreamy. And so I need some more like concrete knowledge or something. So I changed to history. So I went to study history. And after 2-3 months, I was like, I'm not going to be able to sit on a chair for 4 years. And I had been, during working at the Film Academy and organizing the debates, and during my high school, I also started filming my own film, actually, about the house of a friend of my mother, where they, it's like an old barn behind a farmhouse of his dad, where they, from 16 on, they made that their own house. They built it completely with their own hands. Really, at that time, all of a sudden, in 20 minutes, it burned down because of an electricity problem.
Jesus.
Yeah. And I was really curious at that time, like, what does stuff mean to us? Or, like, what is material? So I started filming when I was 15, I think, and then I filmed again a few more times throughout the years. And then I think I was 18 when I went to study, and then I realized I cannot do this, and I filmed again, and I started editing this film. I quit university, and I did an internship at AT5, the Amsterdam Television, at the documentary program, and I just submitted for the Film Academy. But it was almost like I didn't really think about it. I thought the highest possibility for me artistically was to do like Tegenlicht.
Like a very thoroughly researched, professionally made TV reportage kind of situation.
Yeah. Like television journalism. Yeah. And then only during Film Academy, I realized that my, and especially documentary, it's such a wide a genre. I mean, it can be anything. But then there's what we call artistic documentary. And I just discovered, like, wow, but for me, the power is really in, like, small, very authentic personal stories that address these bigger questions or something. I actually really felt the power of stories in, like, very personal. It's not that I lost interest for the big abstract analysis of the world. I love it. I still love watching Adam Curtis or... But to me, it's kind of also where I find the experiment with form. And I really feel that film comes to life in when you treat it in a certain way. And it's a language that we keep developing. And that's something that really, really interests me. That's where I really feel that I also come to life kind of in a way as a, in the joy of filmmaking when you... When you think about form and how form supports a story, what you can do already with this, I'm sometimes thinking about immersive or like VR. Like that's like next level, but already with, in the classical film, I really enjoy that process.
This is also very interesting to me because you say that you come from this very specific background in documentary filmmaking, and I see this curiosity, by the way, in all of your work, also in form and in the ways that the film form can communicate all of these deeper meanings maybe as well. It makes total sense maybe that with Witte Flits you pick a story that is so, like we said, existential and that it feels so very much closely related to the now and to discourses that we're having. Yet you didn't completely answer the question yet of what it essentially was then within this material that made you realize now in the position where you are as a filmmaker, I'm going to jump on this and this is going to be a film or a story that I will translate into a fiction work.
Yeah, also there, I think it's not that explicit that you decide upon that or something, mm-hmm. or at least to me, it happens. Like I saw these, so I graduated in 2012 mm-hmm. from the Film Academy as a documentary director. In 2013, I saw the parents in a TV show, Spraakmakende Zaken.
And these are the parents which are, let's say, translated to the parents that we see in the film that are somewhat of the protagonists of the film.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So it's the actual parents. And the psychiatrist was also in the audience at the time in the talk show. And I have no idea exactly. I was at home. I didn't watch that much television because I became a little bit like this elitist Film Academy artistic documentary.
I don't watch TV. Yeah.
So I think it's good to be honest about that. You have all these faces. But when I saw them telling their story and the loving way they did that and the way they did that together, I almost fell over. It really struck me that this is like, it seems the story of all stories. If all the films we make are like hero's journeys in which you, in that sense, there is a classical drama form where you have to overcome all these external obstacles that lead you in the end towards your internal struggle that you have to do. And I thought, this is the most bizarre classical story in a way. It feels a bit strange to talk about maybe in that way, but...
No, it makes sense. And just to contextualize it for the listeners, it's the parents who have to also accept the fact that their son wants to pass away and that he needs help with that, and that they also have to support him in this journey, which is then maybe what you call this hero's journey, or that you can put that story within the hero's journey framework, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
They have to overcome maybe the obstacles of their own love to be able to accept the loss of their child.
Yeah, exactly that. And I
it already makes you tear up a little bit, I think, now, or it makes you, if I think, a bit emotional thinking about it.
Well, it's just something that when I saw it, so specifically these people tell their story, I was just full of admiration of these people, very grounded, very, like, very working class family from the suburbs of Amsterdam. And the way they spoke about it with no... Puha, we say. They didn't make it any bigger than it was. You would hear their struggle completely. It was in 2013. In 2012, their son, so it's a middle son, he has an older sister, younger brother. They both had families, and he was 42 in 2012, and that's when he got his request for euthanasia because of mental suffering granted. So they had let him go. And they spoke about it so courageously because of it being without any bragging or like, how do you say, there's a word for it, but I cannot really find it.
They weren't upselling what they were doing. It was just very real.
Yeah, very real, very honest, very... first, I found a way to get in contact with them because I was just very interested. And during Film Academy, I had come to the conclusion that I wanted to make observational films so that you actually, story unfolds in scenes a little bit more like we would say in a classical fiction film, mm-hmm. that you are present as a viewer when things take place and that you try to find these time frames in which people go through things. So I went to meet them and I just very openly spoke with them and I asked them, do you think that would be possible to make a film about parents that go through something like that in those last 6 to 8 weeks, the last phase of trajectory for. And with him, it took 9 months of research and then the last 6 to 8 weeks, I think it was 6 weeks, before he got the final grant, so that the euthanasia granted. So that's also the last phase that you see in the film. And I developed then a document because they said they thought it could be done. And I specifically felt it had to be about the parents. Like, I wanted to know, how do you make breakfast in those last 6 weeks? Like, how do you peel an apple? How do you go to bed? How do you close the door behind you? How do you prepare for something like that? So I started researching and working together with Levens and Einde Kliniek at the time, the Life Ending Clinic, very Dutch way to name it, like very direct, also very honest. But it's now the Expertise Center for Euthanasia, in close collaboration with the psychiatrists there, really slowly researching, do we think we can make a film about this? Because also there I really felt like I support the theory, but does it survive reality?
Mm-hmm.
What happens if in those last 6 weeks? It didn't have to include the death itself. It was more about what does it look like trying to let go?
Yeah, it's a process of anticipation,
yeah,
and of living with the knowledge of it probably really going to happen, right?
Yeah.
You showed it in the film in such a marvelous way, exactly through its banality, I would say. Heightened banality, almost exactly like you describe, that every single action gets a different significance with the knowledge of what it is literally leading up to, or the seconds that are passing coming closer to this specific moment. That must have been quite a challenge, to translate that awareness and this feeling into actions, into film, and still impose that meaning on them. What was that research process like on the artistic level to try to capture that sensation, capture that aspect of these final weeks?
Well, I think what helps is that I researched for years. We got the documentary granted by the Media Fund. Then the Media Fund was cut because of political decisions. Mm.
Many political decisions.
Yeah. So there was like 5 years of research, and the money was there, but then it became very difficult in society, so... And the broadcaster didn't dare to make an observational film anymore. So I had to let go. And
wow.
That was very tough.
Yeah.
But I think that you take all that research with you, of many stories, of like recognizing what it could look like, these processes. I realized that I had still sometimes contact with the parents of the first story, because I asked them, can I sometimes call you if I have like ethical questions or dilemmas, or so I called them. And now it was already a little bit that I didn't speak to them, and then I called the mother. I was actually living in Greece, in Athens, and I told someone there, a film friend, about the story, and the person said, you gotta work on this film still. So I called her, can we talk about maybe finding a way to put your story into a film in another way, and in a collaborative way. The father at the time had passed away very suddenly, and he had left 700 handwritten pages of notes throughout the years, because the psychologist advised them to write it, also for them, the process. So every Saturday, they would have a steady visit on Wednesday and Saturday to their son. Throughout the years, every Saturday after that visit, he would sit down and write.
My God, what an archive. That's incredible.
Yeah, and she hadn't read it.
Jesus.
So I went to visit her. She's the coolest person in the world, wisest and funniest. And she gave it quite a thought. Do I want to do this? And then she said yes. And then we did every 2 weeks, I think, a whole day of like audio recordings of conversations all day, slowly reading through his notes, also some notes of the son. And there you find, it's like, the father was so specific in his writing that some of the dialogues is literally from his notes.
I'm completely blown away, because you feel that lived-in reality in the film. Like, I think you can sense it even without knowing this story, but to hear this makes so much sense, while it also being an extraordinary story. That's very powerful.
Yeah. The funny thing is that almost every scene finds its origin in the real story. Mm-hmm. Like, in that sense, I mean, life is the best script writer. it's really, there's so much absurdity in the way, especially, I mean, it's also, for me, Dutch culture is, it's also a study of Dutch culture in a way.
Yeah.
And I found so many weird things, but also, for example, the fact that the parents are really kind of mirroring each other in the process, while she's in the beginning rationally really convinced that they have to support him in his fight for his humane death in the form of euthanasia, and the father is really like, we should look into more possibilities. He doesn't want to go there, and then they literally, when we were reading it, it was very beautiful also to see that she also really read that she more and more often started doing things like saying that she was afraid that he wouldn't do it, or kind of coming up with things that maybe could still, yeah, slow down the process a little bit, and doubts coming up, and the father actually more and more saying, I think we should, you've been right, and we should be letting go. Now to your question, how you translate that in artistically. In the film, I really try to work with it because it's a low-budget film. That's very, very little money to make a film with, even though it's still a lot of money. But it's just you really, really have to also write from that perspective.
Yeah. What does that mean? You have to tighten everything and condense the locations and make the scenes very like compact? Or what does that? What did it actually imply for you?
It meant, for example, that there's a lot that we tell in sound. So sound through the telephone, for example, a scene by the highway where the sun is, the car broke down and the sun runs out and runs in onto the highway. Of course, first I wanted to film that scene, and then I wanted to film that she comes to pick up the father when the sun is already gone. But it's just finding a piece of road where you can film this, is, and then with vehicles, working with vehicles that have to be towed away and stuff, it's really, so everything is, but at a certain point it becomes like a style or something, yeah, very sober,
a stripped down approach.
Yeah, and but for example, what I really thought about is like, well, how can I, of course it's a big challenge, like it's a very mostly inner process. I mean, you have the mirroring of the parents, but it's really something internal, what they go through.
Mm-hmm.
How can you find things that represent that? And it's actually, it's the landscape on the outside is sometimes the landscape on the inside. It's so they all have their elements. The mother has water. It's like a subconscious that's constantly present, and the leaking tap, and you hear it going through the radiators and from the heating, and there's this lake that they live close by that's kind of working, pulling on her. And then there's the father that's with earth. He's always laying down below the car or sitting in the beginning. He's like rooted so firmly that he's like, it's too firm. He can, and slowly he comes up and she goes down.
Mm-hmm.
He, in the end, he also really pulls her up again. And then the son plays with fire a lot because he says he's the devil.
Yeah.
And then there's the element of wind that kind of tries to pull everything together. It's pulling on the house. In the beginning, you hear it when the perspective floats into the house. You hear the wind kind of pulling, but it's also the wind in the trees that constantly is kind of that wanting to pull his soul away or something. And that's something that comes back then later on, which I think is, it's these small elements of like, and how we also always try to frame nature, that it's always like a, but this nature is this thing that it's boiling up inside of her, the parental instinct, the motherly instinct of the impossibility of letting go.
Yeah, and the preservation of your child. It's beautiful, this metaphorical approach, which on the naked eye you might not consciously pick up on, but then that you feel that presence in it. And it reminds me of a previous short film of you, Anahit, which is a film that heavily plays with metaphorical and symbolic film language. And if we're talking about the way that you incorporate film form into the way that you construct narratives, this one is very strong, literally also because it features a lot of danced choreography that convey a lot of the inner feelings of the characters. So you've had experience with combining these things already. I'm wondering if you see a relationship between the two, or how the experience of Anahit maybe has also informed the way that you could approach a more sober, realist style like Witte Flits.
I was really happy that Ciara Jansen, who's the protagonist in Anahit, and so the main dancer, also great actress, when she approached me to do this film, because I thought it's such a good way to challenge yourself to really try to tell a story without dialogue and with movement, with the body language.
Maybe it's good if we tell a little bit what the story has to convey of the film.
Yeah. It's a woman that visits a swimming pool, and by that the memories of a sexual assault boil up. She's trying to resist, and actually at a certain point she has to go through it and face it and face the memory in order to live through it and come out stronger on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
There's a relation in the sense that I really love reading about certain mythologies. I'm really a huge fan of Joseph Campbell's study, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, and the way storytelling across the globe that derived apart from each other, independently. What are the shared things, and how specifically different they are in a way. And I really, sprookjes,
fairy tales, myths.
I really love those, and I think it's both in Anahit and in Witte Flits that I try to at least open my own sensitivity to how can I incorporate those. And I guess film is actually really a great medium to do that, because in literature you can describe how the wind blows through the leaves of the trees, but in film you can actually have people hear that.
But it's funny, because I usually feel like film could be also a very difficult and inflexible medium, because very often you're supposed to show the thing, right? If you want to convey that the wind is blowing, you have to show the wind blowing and rustling the leaves of a tree. It's so interesting that apparently sound then became a very specific approach to you, but also the fact that these metaphors and these layers underneath it can already convey so much without explicitly conveying them, which is often a limitation in realist film. You have to show the thing for people to believe that the thing is actually happening. So it seems like you found some very creative ways to deal with that problem of the medium, I would say.
I feel also the most joy in inventiveness. It's like film is also, you could say, problem solving, or just being inventive how to do things. So in that sense, limitations are also really good sometimes, because it really makes you have to be creative in order to find a way to tell something. And sometimes it's much better when it's limited.
Does this also explain, because the film itself, you talked about this more sober style or this kind of stripped down approach, which was partially out of necessity, but then there's a couple of sequences in Witte Flits where you have this more sweeping tracking shot where the camera really goes either to this clinic thing or through a house, where you kind of get a sense of the skill of the story and kind of almost the passage floating through time and space past all of these characters and people that inhabit this space. I liked it a lot because it gives a sense of presence also of the filmmaker in the material, instead of only a registration of the story as it unfolds. Can you talk maybe a little bit about maybe some of the philosophy behind those moments?
Yeah, definitely. No, it's been there from the beginning in the script already, that I talked with Myrthe Mosterman a lot.
She's the cinematographer of the film.
Yes. And I really like making rules or translations of certain things. And this was something we really talked about, as maybe this perspective is a little bit of his soul trying to pull away already. But then at a certain point, we kind of had the feeling, or maybe it's the navel string.
umbilical cord.
It's kind of the soul, that perspective, the soul of the relation between the mother and the son. In that sense, it's in the beginning, it's kind of his presence floating into the house, and then that makes the phone ring, and him kind of coming in. And there's a moment where it's much more her kind of gut feeling of her, a fear she has of a moment she lived many times, and maybe also a foreseeing that it will be happening maybe again, or the fear of that at least. We talked a lot about the style of the filming, that because I wanted to work with nature as a translation of something on the inside being on the outside, then we decided to start like in a CinemaScope kind of way, but then with a lot of depth of field, in order to make constantly these surroundings important, and to feel that you constantly are in also in this Dutch, like organized, everything is organized and small, or like a very white and cut away. That was very difficult for me. And I'm curious whether you consciously experienced that the film opens.
It's good that you say this Dutch thing, this boxed in thing, because I also wanted to ask about that there's just this interesting kind of tension in the film between things taking place also in a lot of cramped spaces, in a lot of like rigid infrastructures, but that the scope of the film, of course, is much, much bigger, and that these two, there's a strong interplay and a very interesting dynamic between them. So I definitely felt that, and that's why I also was very curious about how these more sweeping camera movements came about. But it's also a thing in general that I was very curious about, and a thing that I'm always very fascinated with Dutch filmmakers is we often in the Netherlands perceive ourselves as not interesting, and often have, you know, we hate it when we meet other Dutch people when we're on a holiday, where we have this kind of like this built-in self-hate almost, as in we are not interesting enough to look closely to ourselves and to each other, especially in arts and entertainment maybe. And then sometimes a film comes along like yours that gives you such a profound perspective also in how these little dynamics and the nuances and the layers in these kind of ways of Dutch cultural communication, and you nail it, I think, very well. And I was wondering what that process was like of capturing it. And to be honest, a big part of that, and it's also a question about working with the actors, is Raymond Thierry and René Zoutdijk, and the way that they portray these characters, these parents that have to go through this process, which is partially very emotional and partially also very clinical and medical and bureaucratically and logistically involved. So it's a pretty big question, I guess. But what was it like to try to capture this? In Dutch, we have this beautiful word for it, occasionally kneuterige, banal aspect of the story, while also finding these like beautiful characters grounded within it.
But it's a great question. I guess a big part of it is in the research, is that it is literally in that story. I mean, yeah, we literally filmed in the house of the mother, which she proposed and then insisted on it.
My God.
Yeah, so it's in that sense, I got even a lot closer than reading the 700 pages. I spent so many days with her. We really became life friends. Mm-hmm. And she has read every serious version of the script. She's seen every serious version of the editing. She even came in sound design once. And she's amazing. So she's also a great criticizer. The first edit I showed her, she said like, no, I don't feel it.
Oh, fuck. How do you deal with that? Because there's an incredible responsibility on your side as well to honor this life story and her personality.
No, I think that's really has been a dialogue between us where she really, I think, trusted me and first dared to trust me, and then I hope I didn't let her trust down. I think it was a very intensive process together, like a really, really back and forth, and very emotional, of course. It's like she had to go through the whole thing again. That's why she doubted for a moment. But because her son had asked them on his deathbed, can you fight for people like me? She decided to participate. And then that trust, I think, grew. And I really loved that she And that's, I think, where the friendship also really started. She said, but I want you to make your film. Mm-hmm. It's your film and you have to make it the way you want to make it. That actually became my responsibility more than that she was sometimes looking at me and saying, but is this how you want to direct it? Or so that became a very beautiful, very, gunnen, how do you say that? That you favor mm-hmm. a lot for the other.
Bestowing, actually, yeah.
Bestowing, yeah. And I think that's also the essence of it, because I think there's we have a culture of efficiency in a way, and sometimes that becomes very cold to me. But it really depends on the people. They are very quite Dutch family, but there's such a huge beating heart and a very beautifully breathing soul in these people that's so warm and so giving, and so also by being strict sometimes, by saying, no, this is my border or something. And I think I really, because of this friendship with her, and also with, of course, I've met the father, I've met the sister, the brother, their families. They also read the script. I met the psychiatrist, of course, but also his friends of the son, that actually we went through all his pictures. They gave us for the film the football outfit he's wearing mm-hmm. in his last run is from their club. Mm. I guess it's also about how you bring something to life. It's just, it's being curious about everything there is to find. And then if you respectfully ask whether you can use it to bring the story to life and are open about what you're doing with it, then yeah, most people said, yes, please, let it help to enrich this story. That we lived.
It's so beautiful, and I keep coming back to this idea that you feel the presence of all of these things in the film, even if you don't know all these facts behind the scenes, maybe. And I'm just kind of curious, because this film could have been made, or the story was supposed to be made a long time ago in a completely different iteration, and now it's this other iteration, and the passage of time has gone over it. And there's maybe a totally different relationship that some of the people that you're very closely involved with, apparently, what they have with this story. This is a bit of like a question of fate and destiny, but do you feel like now, looking back on it, that you're grateful that this is now the version of the film that is being made, and that it was maybe also supposed to be made in this way instead of as the documentary that you once envisioned?
Well, yeah, I think it's, at least I enjoy it a lot, that mm-hmm. It has enriched me as a person, I think, also a lot of all the experiences that I got to live through. I don't want to sound too spiritual. Or,
yeah. I am pretty spiritual, yeah. So.
It's funny, did an interview together with Meerte Mosterman, the DOP, and we were talking about the swan. And it's kind of like, in that way, it's like this. Already when I was researching, this swan was just there all the time. It's a couple, or like, and they had even a child that was like this ugly...
Mm-hmm. Ugly duckling.
Yeah. But that was at the time of filming, when I researched, of course, around the lake a lot in the, let's say, 6 months before that, or a year even. And constantly this swan just came, this one swan. It always came to, I don't know, out of curiosity or something. And so at a certain moment, I did say, like, we had to film at night at the lake. That was the first thing we filmed at the lake, because it was cold. It was getting colder. And I was constantly saying, like, and then there will be the swan. And then we filmed it. And everybody was like, oh, laughing at me. Really, like, oh, Laura with the swan, trying to manifest it, that it's going to be there or something. And I was just like, I don't know why, but I'm just... it's going to be there. And I was really making jokes about it, stupid jokes. And then Meerte was standing in the water with the stunt man and getting ready. And we just had put the lights there. And then I said, man, it's this one. And she was kind of reluctant, because she said, this animal? Like, and I also said, like, I don't know exactly.
Just film it.
Yeah, just film it, please. you see the light even being put on it a little bit, but it's just, it has something weird, and it had to be there. She kind of still thinks that it's not, she said she feels it's not necessary, and I feel it's just in there. With editing, it's just, it had to be there, and it brought me to, in the end, the music also.
Mm.
All the times we filmed at the lake, every time the swan came, so we have all these moments in the film, and in the last week of filming, we filmed for 4 weeks, the night before we had to film the final moment of the sun, I was like, I slept 2 hours and then I woke up. That was during shooting. It's just, you cannot sleep. It's like,
no. You're overthinking everything, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And feeling also. Yeah. And then I was like, this swan, what is with this swan? There is something. And then I Googled it in mythology, in the old Greek mythology. The swan is, feels its death coming and wants to one more time burst out into the most beautiful song he can sing in order to sing on the celebration of the rewards of Apollo that are going to come in the afterlife. It's not the fear of death, it's actually...
Embrace.
Yeah. And I was like, I think I know there's something with this swan song in music. And then I came to Schubert that has the Schwanengesang. And I found this piece of music that I was like, this is it. So I played it also on the set the next day. And of course, you check, like, is the composer dead for over 70 years? So you can use
That's
it.
That's quite convenient, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Schubert has been dead for quite some time. Yeah. It's quite nice.
Yeah, but it's like, it's very difficult. All the music was written in script, and this was just like, I want. And then I thought, this is the thing. Like, in the film, the swan is kind of announcing that the sun is asking, will you let me burst out into my last song?
Yeah.
In order to then let me go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, so it's a conceptual thing, but I think you feel it, that the music is, it's there all the time, and it's slowly becoming more like a real piece of music. Like, it's, the film is allowing the music to become... Yeah, song.
I love this associative logic, which makes a lot of sense, but it's an emotional and poetic journey in many ways.
Yeah, and I think you also feel those things. Mm-hmm. Like, that's exactly what I think is very important, that it, all the rules and concepts you think, and the rules also that the film then breaks or something, it's all because it's storytelling through emotions or through feelings. Or yeah, I think that really... It's the way of working that I really love. So then, in that sense, is it fate? It feels like, that's, I think, the most beautiful moment with the film, when you have the feeling, when you come up with these concepts and everything, but then when the film starts sometimes breaking its own rules, then it becomes its own entity. Mm-hmm. It's like an autonomous thing all of a sudden that starts breathing, and like, it starts wanting its own thing in a way.
That's so beautiful. Well, you know, next week the film is playing at the Netherlands Film Festival as the opening film I mentioned at the beginning. Right now we're also in an anticipation of that. How are you feeling about this whole, you know, the film is going to be perceived by a lot of people in the Netherlands? What are your expectations or feelings at this very moment?
A lot of excitement, also tension, like and just very much, it's curiosity is a maybe strange word, but I am just really hoping it empowers the discussion. I think it's really important that we are having this discussion. It's actually now at this moment very heated.
Yeah, it's very, very alive. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, on the topic of, are we not becoming too easy with euthanasia and in cases of mental suffering. And I have to say, I was quite shocked by hearing that also 17-year-old to 16-year-old people got it. For me, that's like a whole new world in a way, and a whole new part of the discussion, like, how long should someone suffer in order to be able to decide that it's unbearable and without perspective. But what I really hope that a film can do is do actually exactly that, what I said in the beginning, talk, contribute to the very theoretical discussion on another level. In a way, the family in the film is, of course, you could also say it's also a metaphor for the family we form as a society.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yeah, if we look at it that way and if we feel through it in that way, what do we feel we should do on with this? And what do we then feel is right to how to construct these trajectories and these processes? And I really have a lot of difficulty sometimes with this culture of efficiency we have, but I think in actually in this specific case that I filmed, I think it's something I'm proud of, that I live in society where we take the effort to do, facilitate, and really, really, really think about, constantly, keep constantly reflecting on it. In the story of the family I filmed, are we doing the right thing? Are we evaluating constantly? Yeah, I think that's something we should definitely not lose out of sight. It should. I even approached, or we are working on approaching the psychiatrists that wrote a letter, and that they are worried that it's becoming too easy. And I'm hoping really that the film, in a way, is also an entrance into this conversation.
That's a beautiful segue to the final question that we always ask in our podcast interview episodes, which is, what is maybe a specific hope that you have for the future? Because there's many things to consider here, but what is a personal outlook or view that you have, which maybe also gives you some hope to draw from?
It's a difficult time, of course, and I mean, I'm very curious also what will happen being there with new Minister of Culture and what the new government will do and in what way politics will develop in any way. I mean, it's very strange times, and we live in multiple universes, I think, at the same time with digital world and so it's a very layered thing. But I, as a filmmaker, I really hope that we really, really keep embracing the power of stories and the power of human look at each other, like of having an open view and approaching things with curiosity, openness, and that we dare to keep asking questions more than to constantly want to give answers. And I think that's in looking at another person and looking a person in the eye, is like that's something that we can also do, I think, in film in a way. And then you can never ever condemn someone or hate someone, I think really now, all that's going on in the world, that's one of the most important things, that we create the space to look each other in the eye, whether it's through a medium I completely love, which is film, but also in the physical world, and by making it possible to make those things happen. And I do think culture in that is a very, very important department, let's put it that way. Yeah.
Laura, thank you so much for your beautiful film and for your beautiful answers and stories. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. The pleasure was all mine.
You can book tickets to see Witte Flits via the link in the show notes or at lab111.nl. We obviously hope to see you there. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, music from myself, and artwork by Studio FFF.